Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, December 18th, 2011. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Beau is once again with us this week. Hello, Yvonne.
I'm here. Yes, I am.
We sort of had a clusterfuck last week in terms of connecting with each other.
Well,
so.
but it was beyond that. I mean, I announced over here that my wife is pregnant. I had this sympathetic nausea symptoms.
Oh, nice.
Last Monday, Sunday, and Monday. Okay, all right. Monday was actually worse than Sunday, if that's possible to believe. But I mean, Sunday morning was awful. But then the rest of the day, after like 2 or 3 o'clock, it was fine. But Monday, it was just a whole fucking day. I was just like, I don't know. It's just ridiculous. I spent the whole day nauseous. The whole damn day. It was just...
I feel bad for you. I'll tell you, this has not been a healthy world on my side of the fence either. Like, I haven't... No, stomach nausea kind of things. But, like, there's been some sort of fairly bad cold thing that's just been going in circles around my family.
Oh, Lord.
So, like, there has not been a day, it seems like, in months where there wasn't
nobody
at least
sick.
Where nobody
sick.
Has been sick. Yeah, there's always been at least somebody. And for the last couple of weeks, I guess 2 weeks ago, Alex was the one sick. He is, coughing, fever, blah, blah, blah. And then, because, he's little, of course, and isn't allowed to go to daycare when he's sick like that. That meant various ones of us were staying home or doing things while he was sick in order to stay home with him. And then he finally gets better, and everybody else gets sick.
No, God.
And so, last weekend, I Friday, I worked from home because, in the morning, I was like, and I had no meetings, and I'm like, okay, I'll work from home. I made it until about between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, and then I just collapsed.
Nice.
Because it was getting worse as the time progressed through the day. And then I'd say I had peak sick at that point, sometime Saturday night, Sunday morning-ish, I guess. I don't know. And then I was back at work on Monday, but, by Thursday... I've been like, okay, it's getting better, it's almost gone, and then it started getting worse again.
Nope.
And so now I'm, coughing, and the last couple of days I've been, anyway, wonderful stuff.
Well, that's not good. That's not good at all. So, anyway.
We have a show. First of all, so the agenda for today, first the Republicans, and, Yvonne and I were talking right before the show, and let me warn our listeners here, chances are pretty damn high that from now until, say, I don't know, the beginning of November next year, chances are pretty damn high that election-related stuff will be on the agenda every single damn week.
Now, one caveat that I just remembered. Look, it could be, for example, if for some reason, even though it doesn't look likely right now,
then everything gets wrapped up.
Right. The Republicans get wrapped up early for some reason. Say, I don't know, Gingrich goes and takes a piss in public in front of, everybody. I don't know, something. Who knows? I mean, anything can happen. But I don't think that...
There might be a lull in the middle somewhere.
Right. There might be a lull. Yes.
And maybe not. We'll see. I mean, even if they wrap things up early, I mean, that just means the general election is kicking off, right? But you're right. There might be a lull sometime. There may be a week where we're just so damn sick about it that we're like, okay, for this show, we're going to talk about pudding.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed.
Anyway, so we're going to talk about the Republicans. Then we're going to talk about the NTSB has proposed banning cell phones in cars completely nationwide, with some exceptions. We're going to talk about browsers and the browser wars and Chrome and Firefox and Safari and IE and all that fun stuff. And finally, I think it's worth just making a note of events in Iraq. So, let's get started. The Republicans. Now, first of all, I'm gonna the tradition continues. I'm gonna give some poll summaries to start with. First of all, national, even though national doesn't matter that much, I'm using Real Clear Politics's site again for this, although TPM's averages are pretty nice as well, and I may switch at some point, I don't know, and polls and votes I've also been tracking and looking at their site. All of these are good. Anyway, Real Clear Politics, nationwide, Gingrich definitely peaked. You know, I'd like to say I called it because I posted on my blog.
You did say so, that Gingrich is going to go through a peak and that he was going to, you know.
Well, no, not even that. But I posted on my blog a thing that says, peak Gingrich soon, ? And a chart.
Yep.
And it turns out I did that at almost exactly the peak. So, yay, go me. Now, having said that, he has outlasted, he's lasted longer than I thought he was going to, but, you know, I think I was being a little pessimistic at how quickly he would collapse, because if you look at, you know, how long the Perry peak lasted, and how long the Kane peak lasted, and how long the Bachman peak lasted, each of them were actually ahead in the polls, not just for a couple weeks, but more like a month. You know, maybe even a little bit more than a month. So, you know, he's looking back at the history here, his peak is about as long as the other guys. Anyway, he's down to 23%, which puts him only 4.3% ahead of, who's number two?
Mr. Romney!
No! Ron Paul!
Are you fucking kidding me?
Ron Paul is in second in the, oh, sorry, I apologize. I jumped ahead. I'm looking at Iowa. Yes, Ron Paul is ahead in Iowa.
Oh, for God's sakes.
So, back to the Nationals. Yes, Romney is still in second.
Okay.
By a healthy margin. So, nationally, Gingrich, and we'll talk about Iowa in a second. Gingrich, 32.4%, ahead of Romney by 9.8%. Romney in at second, 22.6, and he dipped a bit and heading back up again. Then Paul, 9.6, Bachman, 8.2, Perry, 6.8, Santorum, 3.4, Huntsman, 3.4, and they're not counting Kane anymore.
I wonder when we're going to have that Santorum surge.
You know, I think that this may not be his year.
Damn.
Because I think, you know, it looks like we might have a Paul surge. But Santorum's just is not heading much of anywhere.
I don't think anybody really likes Santorum. I mean, I you know, it's just one of these things where, you know, I mean, nobody likes him. I mean, yeah, nobody does. So
then Iowa.
Now let me at least see this thing.
So the bottom line is, look, what happened here, and it's been concentrated in Iowa because they've been running lots and lots of ads in Iowa, but
right.
It's obviously spilled over nationwide, is Gingrich got ahead, and everybody else is like, what the fuck? This isn't going to happen, and like started piling on the negative ads against Gingrich.
Right, right.
And
right.
That includes, you know, the sort of the national Republican establishment.
Oh, yeah, the National Republicans now has been, like, just, I mean, like, I mean, after Gingrich, big time. I mean, you know, usually, you know, let me give you an example. The editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, they've been hammering away at Gingrich like they're not, like there's no tomorrow. I can't remember, one of the things that recently I was like, reading about is, like, you know how Gingrich did, like, a few years ago, this ad for Al Gore?
The thing with Pelosi.
Right.
Yeah.
And now he's like basically like, you know, totally like, you know, everybody is like jumping all over him because now he's saying, oh, no, that's all bullshit. I really didn't agree to it. Really? I mean, you fucking came on an ad and said you did. And it was voluntarily. So yeah, he's getting like piled on by
everybody.
Everybody.
And yep. Everybody's digging up the miscellaneous things from the past. You know, in one of the debates, Romney even quoted something like from one of his like science fiction novels or something crazy. You know, but yes, because apparently Newt Gingrich also, as part of his history, has, you know, written bad novels of various sorts. Apparently his favorite genre is alternate history. So he's got a few of like what would have happened if something slightly different happened in the Civil War and things like that.
Okay.
So, you know, go check that out. Go, you know.
But apparently they're not very well written.
I have not read any of these books. I did in the last week read some quotes from somebody who did go through and read some and did some reviews and basically talked about how absolutely excruciating it was to read these books. But I must admit, this probably was not from a Gingrich supporter. So, yeah. You know. Anyway, so we got chaos happening. Iowa is incredibly volatile right now. As I was mentioning, Paul is in second place right now. And really, Paul and Romney are, you know, hovering right near each other. It's Gingrich 23, Paul 18.7, Romney 17.0. And with Gingrich in decline, and 3 weeks, only 3 weeks left until, less than 3 weeks, sorry, until the Iowa caucuses. They're on January 3rd, I believe. We may well see a situation in Iowa where going into the Iowa polls, it's Paul versus Romney, with maybe Gingrich hanging on to see if he can be as part of that mix. You know, I mentioned last week on the abbreviated show, you know, caucuses are not like primaries. It's not like everybody goes to a booth and pulls a lever and leaves.
The caucus.
You're so amused by that. You do that every 4 years.
I don't know. My wife keeps pronouncing it like that. I don't know.
But anyway,
she's all confused.
Anyway. So everybody goes in and actually, they lobby each other. You move from group to group. You're expressing your preferences openly, and then people try to convince you to change your mind. You know,
right? And that's one of the reasons why I think like Gingrich has serious difficulty, because he didn't have a very good ground organization, or almost no organization at all on the ground in Iowa.
Well, and frankly, neither did Romney. Romney wasn't planning to compete in Iowa at all. His strategy was basically to say, screw Iowa, I'm starting in New Hampshire, until about a month and a half ago, where he decided, you know, look, it looks like I can compete here, so I might as well. Like, before that, he was going to play the game of like, well, I lost Iowa, but it's okay. I didn't really compete there. I didn't really put any resources in there. But then a month and a half ago, it turns out he was ahead in the polls in Iowa, or not quite ahead, but within...
Near the top?
Near the top. In Iowa, and so he's like, okay, I'm going to jump in Iowa too, and so yeah, both and Paul meanwhile has had an extensive infrastructure going on in Iowa going back 4 years. He never really left. So interesting things can happen here.
That's for damn sure.
And we'll see what happens. And we'll see how much it matters. I was reading a couple articles by Nate Silver, 538, in the New York Times, where he was looking at what do you really take out of Iowa? What matters about Iowa? I mean, first of all, in terms of actual delegates, it's like a tiny amount of delegates. And it's less than they would even normally have, because by going early, they actually violate some Republican rules and lose half their delegates. But they have outsized influence because they're first. But what does really matter there? What it turns out is, if you look at like trying to use the Iowa results to predict anything else, the absolute results of who wins don't really matter that much.
No, I mean, think about it. If I remember, Dole won Iowa back, what was it? What year am I remembering? That year Dole ran. Was it 96?
Yeah.
96. 96, the year that he got beaten for the nomination by, I guess, whatever year that, there was one year that I remember that, Dole won Iowa, and I think it was in the late 80s. I think I'm confusing. Okay. It was when the first George Bush. Dole won Iowa, and he was doing a fucking victory lap that he won Iowa, and then, you know what, then he got crushed the rest of the way, and it didn't matter.
Well, see,
and there's been a number of candidates that has happened. It's not the only one.
Well, yeah, Iowa has often been an outlier, but, you know, what has turned out to matter is how candidates do relative to expectations, specifically relative to what the polls say right before the caucus. So, for instance, if we took today's numbers, Gingrich at 23, Paul at 8.7, Romney at 17. If Gingrich, if Romney wins and comes in first, but does so with only 20%, or, you know, or, let's see, bad example. If Gingrich, being ahead, comes in second, but barely second, he's gonna come out of there really badly.
That's right.
If Romney's in third right now, if he came in third and at about the same percentage that his polls indicate, there'd be almost no effect to him from Iowa. But if he would win, he'd have the momentum coming out of Iowa. Or even if he came in second, he'd come, you know, he'd have the momentum coming out of Iowa. Meanwhile, Gingrich is at 23% right now, and if he won just barely instead of by a significant margin where the polls are today, then he'd be perceived as having a downward momentum, and it would have a major negative effect on his campaign, even though he won. And that's what historically has been shown out of Iowa, is that it matters much more how you do relative to the expectations from right before the voting starts than what you absolutely actually do, win, lose, or draw.
Yep.
And so, you know, and right now, you know, Iowa is looking like, you know, a crapshoot. I mean, and you know, you've got... It actually, you know, we mentioned a possible three-way between Gingrich, Paul, and Romney, but actually, Bachmann, Santorum, and Huntsman actually all have been rising in the polls in the last couple weeks.
God.
Because apparently most of the Kane vote, most of the Kane vote went to Gingrich, at least initially, but... Then, after Kane officially dropped out, most of his supporters had already gone to Gingrich at that point. But the people who are hanging on and still saying they were supporting Kane the last couple weeks, apparently those guys have been going to Bachmann, Santorum, and Huntsman. So, I don't know. We'll see. And then we got New Hampshire.
Romney seems to be in the lead there.
Romney has had a fairly solid lead there all along. Gingrich started to close the gap, but then he's collapsing now. So,
right.
I think, you know, something really major would have to happen for Romney not to get that. And then we have South Carolina is next after that, where Gingrich still has a massive lead. There also apparently hasn't been polling there in a couple weeks, but. And then we've got more coming after that. But the thing is, those are all far enough away that what happens in these first three races will significantly influence what happens. So, like, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that much for you to do a poll in some state later down the line right now. Because everything's going to change based on what happens in the earlier states. Including just who's in the race. I mean, some of these people are going to drop out.
That's right.
You know, and, but, you know, one thing I've been reading a lot about, is how the calendar is actually stacked up in such a way that makes it more likely than it has been in previous cycles, let's put it that way, for this thing to last a while. There are more proportional voting states rather than winner takes all, and the calendar has been pushed back so more states vote later. And so, you know, last cycle for the Republicans, once you got to Super Tuesday, you had, you know.
Yeah, it was, you're done.
Most of the voting had already happened, and most of the states that had already gone were winner takes all, making it a structure that made it very easy for someone to take a lead, and essentially McCain had cinched it by that point. I forget if he mathematically had cinched it by then. I have to look up my old graphs, but... He was way in the lead by then. Whereas this time, the structure of how things are set up makes it much more possible that this drags out longer. And so the scenarios that people are talking about as the most interesting ones, which, you know, probably won't happen, but are basically Gingrich hangs on as a serious contender with Romney. So you have a Gingrich-Romney race at the top, and they're both getting significant numbers of delegates. But at the same time, Ron Paul keeps getting his 10 to 15%, blocking either one of the other two from getting a majority.
Okay.
So that would be the most interesting scenario. We'll see. But we're only 3 weeks away, so we'll know pretty damn fast.
Yep, absolutely. Now, let me ask you a question. I had this question.
Okay.
You know, depending on the outcome of Iowa.
Yeah.
I mean, who do you think is the first one that's going to drop out?
Oh, first candidate to drop out?
Yeah. And after which, do you think, after Iowa or New Hampshire, who do you think would drop out?
I think your whole second tier is going to drop out.
You think the whole second tier is going to drop out?
Bachman, Santorum, Huntsman. I think they don't have huge amounts of financial reserve. They don't have they just don't have the ability to go a long distance. I don't know if it'll be right after Iowa. Let's put it this way. One of those three will probably perform well enough in Iowa
to carry on to New Hampshire.
They feel like they can go on to New Hampshire. If I had to guess, that would be Bachman. So let's say Santorum and Huntsman drop out after Iowa, and Bachman drops out after New Hampshire. And Bachman and Perry, let's say. Here's the thing about Perry. Perry has been going up again race recently. His polls have actually, you know, at least in these early states, have started to recover a little bit. They haven't recovered nationally yet, but Bachman's heading up in the national polls again. But the difference between Perry and these other candidates is he's got money. So he can hang on longer. He can say, I'm hanging on till South Carolina, right, or I'm hanging on till Florida, or whatever. So regardless of where he's in the polls, he's got the money to keep going. Okay. Santorum, Huntsman, Bachman, I don't really think they have a lot of money to keep hanging on. I mean, they may do one of these things where they decide not to campaign actively, but they're still in it or something weird. But I think that they will be effectively out of it after Iowa and New Hampshire, absent some absolutely insane last minute, like, yeah, surprise, like Bachman wins Iowa, you know.
Yeah, that would be a shocker.
Well, I mean, she's not that far behind. I mean, she's in double digits.
It would still be a shocker.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let's take a break and move on to the other things. We've taken a long, long time on this topic, as we are wont to do.
Yeah.
And so, where'd my button go? I need a button. Button. Okay, we're taking a break. We'll be back after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And we are back. So, cell phones and cars.
Okay. Now, so I guess the head of the NTSB is equaling cell phones and cars to smoking cigarettes, pretty much.
In cars.
In terms of harm to society.
The numbers do bear out that a lot of people are affected by this. You know, the number of accidents that have distracted driving as a significant component in why the accident happened is very significant. So there's no question of that.
But the question is, of course, but that's the key. The one thing is, like, distracted driving versus
Versus, you know, cell phones specifically?
Well, yeah, I
think the numbers bear out that a significant portion of that distraction is cell phones. Now, there's no question that other things can be there, too. Like, I saw, just in the response to this happening, I saw somebody who'd done a study, and I'm not going to be able to get the reference. Apologies, guys. But specifically, that there is one thing that is something like 4 times more dangerous than cell phones in the car, and that was... people picking songs on their iPods.
I can see that. Well,
And of course, texting is worse than a phone call as well.
Let me put it this way. I mean, for example, I mean, I've seen people. I had somebody once in front of me get into a really bad wreck. I mean, flip over their car.
Yeah.
Because they were putting on makeup.
Right.
Okay. All right. You crashed into a parked car while you were looking for what exactly was it?
Oh, I dropped something into the footwell next to the passenger seat, and I leaned over to grab it.
Right, and then proceeded to hit a parked car.
Yes.
Now, so
for everybody, just for reference, that was like 15 years ago or something.
Yes, so. Still. Anyway,
I have not done anything like that lately. Well, there was that post, but yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Okay, so my point is that, I mean, here's the one thing. They climb onto this, right? Okay. And my problem is distracted driving versus like certain, because here's the thing. Texting, for example, I understand that. You try to fiddle with your navigation system. You fiddle with looking for that pen that fell on the floor. It's a thing of like how you handle distractions around the vehicle, and not necessarily like the one, that one specific device.
Well, see, here's the thing. I understand you are absolutely right. However, there are studies that show very different results from different kinds of distractions, and cell phone and other devices, but specifically cell phones have been shown to be one of the worst. However, part of the reason is people were like, well, I was talking to somebody on the phone, different than talking to someone in the passenger seat. The difference is the person in the passenger seat can also react if something is going on in the road because they see what's around.
But I'm sorry, but you know what? This is a bunch of bullshit, okay? Because I've got to tell you, look, I've got to tell you something. I trained to fly, right? Mm-hmm. Airline pilots, okay, and everybody, you know what? If there's a more situation where you have multiple distractions that you have to handle, then flying, I don't know what it is. Because when we're flying, you're talking like I know this because I don't know if I've said this before, but I am a pilot. I mean, I learned to fly. You know, you're talking on a microphone on the radio with a control tower where you're having 10 different conversations at once that you're listening to, by the way. Okay, you're supposed to pick out which one is yours. Okay, because they'll call you like out of the blue without, you know, it refer to you. You're having probably a co-pilot or somebody else on the plane that you're talking to regarding to whatever situation you're doing. You have your instruments that you got to be looking at and all the controls. You have a checklist in front of you that you got to be checking, a map, a checklist. Every other fucking distraction to the sun, plus, you know, by the way, a whole bunch of airplanes that are flying around. Well, no, you got
wait. Here's the difference.
The point that I was going to get is that most people, like in that situation, they get trained to do that. Okay. All right. And if you can't handle a certain level of distraction while you are doing those things, let's face it, you're never going to be a fucking pilot.
Yeah, okay? I was going to add just real quick. Everything you listed, it's multitasking, which is different than distraction. Because everything you listed is actually related to flying the plane.
Yes, but while it may be, okay, to a certain extent, it's having a conversation at the same time, looking at a chart, doing something. The NTSB person is actually hitting on multitasking, okay, specifically, by the way.
Yeah, but well, right, because it's the changes of attention that are the places when you're most likely to do something wrong.
Correct.
Here's the thing. Yet, I think there has been significant evidence that all of these things, all of these forms of distraction have negative effects on driving. and have and they are quantifiable. You can tell the difference between fiddling with the radio, fiddling with a cell phone, and doing a hands-free call. They are different. It is quantifiable, and they are all our risks. Now, on the other hand, this is the question of, well, what should you do about that, and should you do anything about that? And so one option is you could be like, okay, from now on, you know, cars are going to be built with a one-person cockpit, no radio, no entertainment, no nothing. You got to watch the fucking road.
Great. So people are going to be falling asleep off their ass off while driving because they are in the most boring and dull environment ever. So therefore, we're going to have an increase in like deaths of people like by falling asleep and crashing.
Well, the most relevant thing is, and I talked about this on the show, I think, like, I don't know, a long time ago, a year ago or something, and I will never be able to find the reference. If any of our listeners find the reference, please email me, and I'll mention it next week. Because of course I'm not going to go look myself. But there was a study done in the places that have actually banned banned texting in the car specifically, I think it was about, but also
banned phone, here where I'm at.
Phone calls in the car, texting in the car without hands free. In almost every one of those jurisdictions, the accident rate has actually increased after that law was passed.
And why is that?
The reason is nobody actually changes whether or not they do the bad behavior. They just start trying to hide it. So the person texting will still be texting, but they'll be holding the phone down by their lap
so nobody can see that they're doing it. Right, so they can't be looking at the road, and then they'll actually crash.
Right.
Oh, fuck. Great. Beautiful.
So, I mean, that's where I think a lot of these laws and these ideas, you have to really look at it empirically, not just say, okay, X is dangerous, so let's ban X. Because there's lots of side effects and things that happen there. So they should be looking and saying, okay, there are municipalities and states around the country who have passed stricter laws around this kind of stuff. Has it worked? And maybe the piece of research I looked at is out of date, and now there's plenty of research saying that it actually has worked. But has it worked? Has it improved safety? And has it improved safety in a way that's worth it, too? Because you have to do the cost-benefit. And
I'm going to say this. Distractions in a driving environment are a fact of life. Okay? Now, I'll be an asshole about this. My proposal would be, you know what? I would say that I would, you know, driving tests for people to get driver's licenses are not strict enough in this fucking country. We allow people that could get way too easily distracted and don't understand how to handle those hazards in a good way. I would say that if you made, you know, I would fucking yank more people's driver's licenses.
So you would do one of these advanced driving simulators.
Yes.
That you know, not only has, can you, with no traffic, can you stop at the right place in front of a stop sign under controlled conditions, but has you driving like a 20-mile course, and every few seconds something unexpected happens.
Yes.
You know, a kid runs in front of you, a car runs a red light, someone swipes in front of you, whatever.
Somebody and you have is to fucking react. You have a kid that starts crying in the back. Who the fuck knows?
And you have to react properly with all that stuff. And you're given tasks like change the radio.
Yes, because you're going to do it. It's the most unrealistic test. Like, you'd go and you get a driver's license test, they will fail you if you touch the radio, okay? That's not realistic. Everybody's going to touch the fucking radio, okay?
What, you don't only touch the radio when you are parked?
Right. Why do you not see if people are doing this properly, okay? Are they continuing to pay attention? Are they all of a sudden just became focused on the stupid thing? What are they doing? We don't teach people to do this shit. Okay? I mean, that's my point. The driver training that we give people to fucking, like, get behind, you know, pieces of metal to weigh thousands of pounds that could kill a whole bunch of people is ridiculous. So, my thing is, better drive. Let's put it to you this way. And
would you do the thing where, like, you know, when you renew, you have to take the test again?
Yes.
Every time?
Yes. I'd say, you know, 10 years elapsed, okay, do the test again.
You know, no one's ever going to go for this.
But you know what? Then what we propose are idiotic solutions. Like, let's do a ban of something like this. That's a knee-jerk reaction instead of doing something that makes sense.
Do you expect anything else out of the government? Come on.
Yeah, not particularly.
I'm frustrated by it too. Like, I fully recognize that it is dangerous to be running down the road texting.
Totally agree. By the way, I don't want anybody to think that I'm advocating people to be texting while driving. I'm not doing that. But my point is that this is like one distraction, like out of hundreds, and that we don't do a good enough job of you know, training people in order to be able to drive and while those distractions are happening. Okay, we throw people out there with fucking no training whatsoever to fucking be handling these machines.
And, I fundamentally think a lot of this just, it has to be a matter of education and personal responsibility kind of things. And I know there are always going to be people who are irresponsible, and there are going to be different degrees. I mean, can I admit to never having done these things? No, I've done these things, you know, I have sent a text while my car was in motion. I admit.
I will admit I've done the same. I don't do it often, but I have.
Right. But, you know, like, it has to... I don't think the regulation here is a way around it. I mean, because these things tend to get out of hand and used disproportionately and... I don't know, and you're absolutely right. They're targeting one distraction as opposed to all distractions. But
the reason is, I'm telling you, you know, you're getting new cars with all these gadgets and all these other things, and we're focusing on the cell phone. I mean, Jesus, they're putting email, they're putting Pandora radio, they're putting like all this shit in like in-dash electronics right now, and we're not handling.
Well, And in the last couple of days, I read one of the descriptions around this was saying that, you know, a design manufacturer goal for a lot of these in-dash things is that a task has to be able to be completed in 20 seconds. And I'm thinking, like, 20
seconds is an eternity.
Yeah, if you're driving down the road at 60 miles an hour, you can't look away from the road for 20 seconds.
That's crazy.
You know, And I recognize what people really do is they glance away, they start the task, and then they look back, and then they go... But, you know, I don't know. If it takes 20 seconds to fucking do, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the car.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's one thing to push the button to hit next radio station, you know?
Right.
Which ideally, you do by feel without even looking at the damn
thing. Right. I go and I do it on the steering wheel. Bip. There. Done.
You know, or whatever. Or you're doing something that you can do while you're still looking at the road. Like, okay, you know, another one of those distractions is eating. Like, if you got your stuff from your fast food restaurant and you're shoving things into your face. But at least for the most part, you can still look at the road while you're doing that. You know? I don't know. But, like, if you've got some task that's taking a considerable amount of time... And I realize some of these things have safety features that supposedly they won't work unless you're stopped. But almost every single one of these devices that I've seen has a little button that says, oh no, I'm the passenger. You know, that lets you override that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've had that. Yeah, I've seen that. But, you know, there's no way to really tell who the hell the person is. Well, I've seen in some cars where I've seen that it doesn't matter. There's certain cars I've been on. Even if they don't let you, period, if the
right.
car's in motion, okay, do certain things like input navigation addresses or stuff like that.
Right.
I've been in some like that.
And that's probably actually smart. Of course, I find that kind of thing aggravating when I'm confronted with it and turn it off if I can. But at the same time, yeah, it's probably the smart thing to do. Anyway, we'll be back after this break and we'll talk a little bit about what's next. Oh, browsers. Browsers.
Browser. Browser.
Yowzer. Yeah, that's right, Alex. Browsers. We'll be right back after this.
Tag yourself with Blue Protection. La 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 la. Take the time for vaccination. La 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 la. Take action every day to help you. La 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 la. Take antivirals if doc says to. La 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 la. These actions every day can help you.
For the most accurate health information, visit www.cdc.gov or call 1-800-CDC-INFO 24/7.
And here we are, browsers.
The browser yowser.
So you wanted to talk about this based on something that came out last week.
There was a news story that just mentioned that, okay, aside from Chrome now being bigger than Firefox, okay, by a small amount, okay, the fact that the single most used browser, now version specific, mind you, not all versions, is Chrome, okay?
Hmm.
This version of Chrome, the latest one, is apparently used more than, say, you know, if you combine all IE versions, IE still number one, but, you know, it's just this latest specific version of Chrome is the most used browser. And it brought to me, I'm like thinking, shit, I mean, I wonder what's the deal with the whole Chrome thing, because that's why I asked Sam whether he was using it. He said he installed it, tried it, and he didn't use it again. The same as me.
I'm opening it up again right now. Just
okay.
Yeah, just see. But you know, one of the things is I may have used it very early and not given it another chance lately, whereas it's had development has been very rapid. Mm-hmm. So it's probably worth another look. So, you know, I'll take another look at Chrome. But I'll tell you, on my Mac, I've always ended up going back to Safari. Because it seemed the most Mac-ish and the most in line with everything else. And the differences between other browsers haven't been that great. I'll tell you, for about a year, I switched to Firefox as my primary browser on the Mac. And by the end of that year, I came to regret it. And switched back. And it lasted a long time. I mean, I got really excited about extensions, and there were a bunch of extensions that I was using, and blah, 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 and that was kind of cool. But in the end, it got sort of slow, and I flipped back to Safari, and then Safari added extensions, and then it was like game over. I'm back there, sorry. You know, because I got everything that I was using extensions for over on the other. I mean, I'm in Chrome right now. There's nothing. I mean, it looks like a browser.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You have to, in order to really sense the differences between these guys, you have to sit and use them for a while. It's like little subtle differences, like how you manage tabs, how you manage bookmarks, how the autocomplete works. In some cases, they're pre-caching certain things in the background, and does that make it feel faster? How does it do it rendering complex dynamic pages? Things like that. How often does it crash? You know, and so you can't tell that by opening it up for 5 minutes. In order to give a browser a decent run, you have to use it as your primary browser for like a week.
So let me give you the numbers, okay? IE all versions, 40.09%. 26.31% for all versions of Chrome. Firefox is at 25.07. Apple Safari, and these are the desktop versions. None of these are mobile versions. 5.86%. And Opera gets 1.91%. Now,
mobile. And then mobile.
I don't have mobile.
Yeah, so I'm looking at Wikipedia has a good table of this. The article name is Usage Share of Web Browsers. And they show these stats from a whole bunch of different sources, and so you can compare. Everybody. Yes, Alex?
Everybody.
What's over there?
Everybody.
Yes, it needs batteries. You can ask Mommy for batteries. Okay. So there's like a whole bunch of different sources of stats. And so, the bottom line here, to me, the story here is not necessarily, you know, Chrome overtakes Firefox. It's that there's a spread, you know, like for the longest time, it was like IE was so dominant.
Right. 90%. Right.
You know, and now I'm looking, the latest numbers that they have here on the Wikipedia table are September. And it's like, you know, 39 IE, 25 Firefox, 21 Chrome, 8 Safari. Those are significant chunks. You know, it's not just like, you know, you're the oddball if you use something other than IE and all the quote unquote normal people use IE. That's just not the case anymore.
No, I totally agree. And you know, because it used to be how many times you used to get to a website, and it was like, oh, well, you need IE to go to this website. And I'm like, oh, screw this. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, so you don't get that anymore from most websites. But I guess my question is, I mean, I don't, what is the significance of this? I mean, let's face it, this is another application that doesn't seem to have a revenue stream tied to it, into which, like,
It depends on who you are. I mean, there are like, you know, for a long time, for instance, Firefox made most of their money for the Mozilla Foundation from the fact that they got a bounty from Google for the search results from their search bar.
Oh, right.
You know, okay. So there is potential money in here, and you know, every single browser, well, except Chrome that has unified them. So you'll notice one of the differences in Chrome is you don't have a separate address bar and search bar. If you type a search term in the address bar, it'll just do a Google search.
That sounded ominous.
He just threw something down the stairs.
Okay, all right.
That's one source of revenue. I don't know where else you really look for revenue in these things, but...
Well, here's a question I got. You just mentioned something that's interesting. I mean, does Apple get a cut of every frickin' Google search that happens in the Google bar in frickin' Safari?
Probably.
I guess so. Huh. Interesting. Well, I mean, the one thing is that it just seemed like kind of like odd that all of a sudden we wound up with a splintered, like, browser environment. And I was just wondering if anybody, I mean, if you had any thoughts on why Chrome all of a sudden has, you know, gained that much popularity. Because I honestly tried it. Maybe I will try to install it again and try it again.
I'm gonna give it another look, because it has been a number of months since I last tried it. And like I said, if you're evaluating a browser, you can't just try it for a few minutes. You have to make it your default browser and use it for like a month.
Well, the thing is I tried it, it was slow, clunky, and didn't work very well. It sucked.
And here's one of the things about Chrome is they've been on a very aggressive update cycle. And Firefox has been trying to catch up with them, but I don't think quite has done it. People have been complaining that Firefox has slowed down due to bloat and people adding too much stuff to it and inefficiencies and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, some of the things people advocate about Chrome are it's nice, clean, it's got a lot of features, it's easy to use. And also, by the way, auto updates itself and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you're not going to have, oh, there are a whole bunch of people using that really old version of Chrome. You know, so, and it's also got, you know, extensions and plugins and all that kind of stuff. I've heard people say good things about it. I will try it again. But again, to try it, I'm going to do this right now. I'm changing my default browser and make Google Chrome my default browser.
Okay.
Boom, done. I'm going to give it a week. Well, so the problem is I'll have to do this on all my computers because...
Right.
Yeah, because I'm actually at my desktop, which I don't use that often these days, but... it's interesting. To me, the main thing is that it's bifurcated again. There's a bunch of competition. There are a bunch of different things out there. They're all more standards-based than they were, you know, back when we had, you know, Netscape versus IE versus whatever the hell else was around back then. One of the biggest problems was they were all making up their own shit. So they were incompatible. So if you were setting up a website, you had to think, okay, now how do I make this in this work in this browser? And how do I make it work in this browser? Now most of these are fairly standards compliant. So you've got a little bit of that, but not a huge amount. Interesting stuff, but also it's also incredibly interesting that IE is doing such a nosedive, even though it continues to be, you know, the default installed browser on Windows, which is still most computers out there.
Okay.
Okay, let's take a break. And we'll be back, and we will talk about a little bit about Iraq and miscellaneous odds and ends. So enjoy your break. Okay, here we are. So I noticed, I said at the beginning, you know, I just wanted to note this, and I don't know how much we really have to say, but on Thursday we had the official ceremony ending our involvement in Iraq, and early Sunday morning, you know, U.S. time, midday, Iraq time, I guess, the last official... combat troops officially left a few months back. The last official military troops left Iraq going back to bases in Kuwait.
Yep.
Now, it has been pointed out, quite rightly, that that is not actually zero. There is still considerable American involvement in Iraq. Now, we can start with there's not even zero military involvement. So for a summary of this kind of stuff, let me point you to, and I did the Twitter reading link thing that I have been doing lately on this, if people want to look. But it's an article in Salon, published on Saturday, December 17th. No, the U.S. is not leaving Iraq, by Justin Elliott in Salon magazine, salon.com. And basically... Even from the Defense Department, there are a very small number of troops left behind for, like, guarding embassies and stuff like that. It's a small number. But the primary, so it's not zero, but very small. The primary left behind, though, is the State Department. There are going to be almost 20,000 people related to the State Department in Iraq still. Now, they're civilians, not military. This is the embassy, which is the largest U.S. embassy in the world, by far, is the one in Iraq. And there are going to be a lot of things associated with that, including private armed contractors. Good old Blackwater lost their contract a while ago, but there are a couple others that do that kind of thing. A company called Triple Canopy, another company called Global, SOC Inc., so there are a bunch of these, private companies providing armed security that are also in the country. So there's a significant U.S. presence there. So we're not there out of there entirely. Having said that, though, for the most part, you know, this is one of those examples of, you know, Obama ran on he's getting us out of Iraq, and he pretty much did. Now, having said that, again, he didn't necessarily want to. If you remember a few months back,
right,
when they were trying to negotiate the status of forces agreement, the Obama administration was actually wanting and arguing for an extended presence lasting past this year.
And Iraq refused to.
Of tens of thousands. Well, basically, they failed to come to a deal because Iraq insisted on the idea that if American soldiers broke Iraqi law, they would be subject to the Iraqi justice system for breaking those laws.
Right.
And the U.S. was like, no, absolutely not. And by the way, if I was the Iraqi president, I'd be saying the same damn thing. I mean, this was prompted by several incidents of, you know, basically war atrocities committed by Americans. There are collateral damage casualties all the time, with civilians killed, and that's very unfortunate. But everybody seems to agree in the end, it's sort of like, oops, we didn't mean to. We were trying to attack the bad guys. We got the civilians, but there were a number of situations where American forces just went into houses full of, you know, families and small children and just mowed them down. Yep. And, you know, because, you know, who knows what the reason why people talk about, you know, the psychological stress and the soldiers kind of snapped and blah, 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 whatever. But, you know, the Iraqis wanted to say, look, you know, this wasn't like a military action. This was a massacre. We should be able to, you know, arrest these people and put them on trial. And the U.S. says, nope, we'll deal with that on our own, which generally means these, you know, the soldiers involved in those kinds of actions got discharged, you know, with the whatever negative discharge is, and got a slap on the wrist and sent home. None of these people are going to jail. But at least last I heard, I could be wrong. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But anyway, there were certain
more egregious cases that were prosecuted. But for the most part, yeah, I don't think that whatever, you know, be it as it may, I don't think that in general it satisfied, you know, the Iraqis felt that the kind of justice that should have been done given some of the things that happened. So, you know.
Yeah. So, bottom line, they couldn't come to a deal. So Obama's like, yep, we're going to honor the agreement that, by the way, was negotiated by George W. Bush that said we would have all troops out by the end of 2011. And so here we are.
Yep. And so here we are.
And
by the way, one thing I kept seeing, like people kept saying that this war only cost $800 billion. That's fucking bullshit. There is no fucking way. This thing must have cost really like more than $2 trillion. I don't care what the hell they're telling me. But, you know, I believe that the cost of what they're saying was all those additional authorizations that were over and above what the military budget was. But if you really count how much really of the military was involved, there is no way that it was just the additional budget authorization.
Right.
So.
Well, and yeah. And with all of these things, you got to be thinking, if you really want to understand the costs, you have to look at all the opportunity costs too. You know?
Right.
All of the things we could have been doing instead of this.
Right.
Not to mention, you know, for that matter, you know, presumably some of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians we killed in this action might have done very useful things with their lives if we hadn't killed them.
Yeah, you think?
You know, yeah, who knows? But I think this has been, yeah, there was some, at the very beginning, there was some, you know, right when we were knocking over statues and blah, 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 and Iraqis were cheering us in the streets, there was some glimmer of hope that, hey, this actually might be something that was good and worth it in the end. But I think what you saw was a rapid downturn after that. You know, first of all, it was a mistake to go in there in the first place because, you know, all of the justifications for going in were basically proven to be false. And right. And not only that, they were, if you look at them carefully, you find that it's not just there was a lot of information and people believed the wrong things and there was no way to know that it would turn out to be false. No. You know, there were experts all over the place telling you that the situation was what it ended up to be. And those experts were ignored in the run-up to the war.
You know, one of the things that keeps being said is that...
Once they were in, they screwed it up.
That Saddam was an atrocious dictator and needed to be taken down. He was a bad guy, blah, blah, blah. And that justified it. I mean, honestly... By doing that, did we really help the Iraqi people?
I bet you. And you know, it's impossible to do a counterfactual on this kind of stuff. Yes, hey, I'll be done in just a couple minutes. We're almost done.
Yeah, Cars.
You want to watch Cars? My computer's downstairs. You can ask Mommy to turn it on. Anyway, it's impossible to really do a counterfactual on that. But we killed so many Iraqis. So many civilian Iraqis. We messed up so much of the infrastructure and didn't repair it. It's hard to believe that, you know, it wouldn't, that we actually are better off. Iraq. Hi, Alex. Maybe I should just wrap it up. Let's wrap it up, Yvonne.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks for another Commercials Corner. It's great to be here again. If you have any questions, emails, or comments, please email us to Ablesmay@ablesmay.com.
Speaking of that, Yvonne, I wanted to ask one question before you went on the show.
Yep.
The next two Sundays are Christmas Day and New Year's Day. Are you going to be here?
Yeah, I wasn't planning on going anywhere. So
okay.
Go away.
Alex is telling you to go away.
All right, I'll go away. Bye, Alex.
Okay, bye, everyone. Thanks. He's waving. You know, tune in next week. Tell everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Say bye, Yvonne. I mean, say bye, Alex. Oh, close enough. Bye, right. Everyone. Later.
Bye.